Hey folks, it's that time again. Time for a live Retronaut show. I'll be heading up to Long Island Retro Gaming Expo at the Cradle of Aviation Museum in Garden City, New York, to talk about the history of Capcom's Super Joe, star of Commando and Bionic Commando, live with the guys from Hardcore Gaming 101. Come see us Saturday, August 11th, and stick around afterwards for an evening meetup. Hope to see you there. This week in Retronauts, conversations with the Mad Overlord. And welcome to another episode of Retronauts. I'm Jeremy Parrish, as usual. And with me this week, we have a very special guest, one Mr. Robert Woodhead, the programmer of wizardry and entrepreneur of other provenances as well.
Oh, good afternoon, or good morning, or good evening, depending on where you are.
So, Robert, thanks very much for coming onto the show this week. I'd love to talk to you about not just wizardry, but about, you know, kind of the place that game has in video game history and about, you know, your influences, your inspirations, and kind of where you went beyond wizardry.
Okay. Well, I'm glad to be here.
So, yeah, I gave the very, very general introduction for you, but I don't know if you'd like to maybe explain a little more about kind of your career and maybe give sort of the high level view of that, just to familiarize some of our audience with the work you've done and kind of the games you've created.
Well, I guess the way I usually explain it is that my career has basically always been doing weird things with computers. In the early 80s, I wrote computer games. I wrote antivirus software a little later. In the late 80s, I started going to Japan a lot and ended up founding one of the first anime releasing companies, Animego, which is still puttering along to this day. I've done basically just a lot of very strange things, often, you know, for bizarre reasons that seemed like good ideas at the time. I basically just blindly stumble around trying to find interesting things to do.
Mm-hmm. How did you land on programming in the first place?
That happened in high school. I found a book in the library called 101 Basic Computer Games, which is one of the seminal books, along with there were another couple of books, but that was one of these seminal books about computer programming that was sort of just generally available. And I got interested in it, and there was just one minor problem. There were no computers. In 1975, there were no PCs, and by accident, I happened to learn that a local college about 30 miles away from my house had a computer. And the only reason I learned this is because that's where I had to go to take the PSATs, and just blindly by accident found out about this. And one of the things I've learned in life is, and that I've always told my kids, is if you don't ask, you don't get. So one of the luckiest things I ever did in my life was I asked, can I come and use this computer? This high school kid went to the college and basically asked. And the guy who ran the computer said, I don't care so long as you do it on weekends when nobody else is here. But I was like 14, 15 years old. So there was this minor problem of, you know, how do I get there? My mother would drive up to the college in the morning, drop me off, drive back home, and then drive up in the evening to pick me up and drive back home. So like 120 miles a day. And she did it usually both Saturdays and Sundays, for my entire, for about 18 months while I was finishing up high school. And that gave me the opportunity to play around first with a PDP-8E, which was one of the standard mini computers of the day, and later via a teletype, 110 bits per second, to an early time-sharing system, the Dartmouth time-sharing system. And that's where I got my early exposure to computer programming. And then I went off to school at Cornell in 1976, and there they actually had computers that I got a chance to use. Admittedly, punch cards and all the old Stone Age, right, stone knives and bearskins type of stuff, but that's where I got my first serious academic exposure to computing. And also, Cornell was one of the few colleges in the country that had something that was very, very special. And they had two Plato terminals. And Plato is one of the great sort of unsung heroes of computing and gaming, because Plato was basically where everything you love about the internet was invented between 1970 and 1975.
So Plato, is that like a programming language or is it a computer system?
Plato was a nationwide computer system. This was run on what for the time was a supercomputer, a cyber CDC 6600. And it supported hundreds of terminals around the country. Now, these terminals, and remember, this is early 70s. They had 512 by 512 bitmap graphics. They had a plasma screen. In fact, the plasma display terminal display screen was invented at Plato. They had touch panels. They could even project microfiche through the display. And it was created, and its ostensible purpose was for computer teaching. In fact, Plato stood for Programmed Logic for Automated Teaching Operations. It was designed to help people write software to teach things. In fact, Plato programs were called lessons. But what ended up happening, what the unintended consequences of that, was that because all these terminals were networked together and they had very low latency, like less than a tenth of a second round trip latency, they generated a social community. And that expressed itself not only in things like message boards and chat and those kind of social things, but also in games. So Plato ended up, the people who wrote games on Plato, which by the way were multiplayer games, you could play with people all over the country, they ended up being the first people who were able to address some of the important problems in computer gaming, game balance, putting multiple people together, synchronization, the social aspects of gaming, especially PvP gaming. Mm-hmm. They were the first people who had a chance to really experiment with those. And that ended up being hugely influential, not only to me, but basically to a huge number of people who were active in the early PC gaming industry. Mitch Kapoor of Lotus, mm-hmm, Plato person. Silas Warner, Kessel Wolfenstein, Plato person. The list goes on and on. And Andy Greenberg and I, who wrote Wizardry, were just two more of those people.
Yeah, I really appreciate you giving some more context to Plato, because it's something that I've read about a lot and heard about a lot, but never really had the importance of it explained. Like, the way you describe it kind of strikes me the way people describe Xerox PARC in the early 80s, like this, just kind of like this incubator for great ideas and visionary technology that would kind of, you know, disseminate into the mainstream and become just part of our lives nowadays.
Yeah, I cannot emphasize enough how important Plato was for the development, I guess I would call it, of social computing, of the idea of people using computers in groups, people interacting over a computer, as opposed to somebody using a computer to solve their particular problem. And that, of course, was totally unintended. The original idea was just, you know, we want to provide lessons. Like, we want to provide an interactive lesson on genetics, so we'll let you breed fruit flies on the screen with graphics, which is one of the sort of standard lessons people would demonstrate to show what Plato could do. And you could just, like, you know, touch the two flies you wanted to breed and see what their offspring would be like. So that's what they wanted to do with it. You know, what it ended up showing people how to do was something way more than that. And that's one of the, I think, most important lessons, is that sometimes the unintended consequences, the sort of like things that you would never think about going in, tend to be the most important products of a particular project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like people, anytime they come across new technology, one of the first things they want to do is make games out of it.
No, porn. Yeah. First porn, okay, then porn. Games.
I don't know if there was porn on Plato, but...
I'll neither confirm nor deny.
Okay, so the second thing they want to do is make games. And, you know, something like Oregon Trail emerged out of this teletype system, which was supposed to be for education, but it became something that was a fun way to learn, and it evolved into a game, and that's still making the rounds. They just came out with... I don't know if you've seen that,
the little handheld
that you get at Target. It's great. And it's crazy because that game was designed, what, 40, 45 years ago? Maybe longer than that. I can't remember the exact date, but it's been, you know, it's decades old, and it's still like this fun idea that people can pick up and play. So I don't know. I have always enjoyed that aspect of the way technology and gaming develop kind of in tandem. You mentioned the fact that, you know, computers were so hard to come by. The idea of computers as a scarce resource, I think, is something that's really alien to the modern world. I'm just old enough that I remember when computers were starting to show up, and, you know, like one in every school or something like that. But yeah, before that, it's really interesting that you would be drawn to programming despite the fact that you didn't have really a means to make use of that interest, make use of that skill. Like, what made you interested in seeking that out? I don't think you really spoke to that. If it was just like some innate fascination, or if you saw, you know, the potential there for something more.
I think it appealed to the way I think. One of the nice things about computer programming is you get to, like, completely control something, you know, you, or at least you have the illusion of control. And, you know, especially for somebody, you know, I was kind of socially isolated and very awkward when I was young, still am to a certain extent. And, you know, there's so many things that are not in your control, but here is something that can be. So I think that spoke to me. Computers were not available, but they were a known quantity. I was a child of the 60s, so you know, I grew up with the space race. I was a huge space fan. And so, you know, that was something that, that informed my interest in technology. I think if I had been born 100 years earlier, I would have definitely ended up being some sort of like an engineer, messing around with steam engines or something. Just the computer stuff was the kind of unusual, interesting thing that turned out to be available to me just at the right time. And, you know, I basically just lucked into it. Mm-hmm. Like if the librarian at the local library hadn't like had some like strange, like twist in her mind, or like, I don't know, maybe she didn't drink her coffee one morning and, you know, didn't play, if she hadn't placed an order for that book, we wouldn't be having this conversation. Mm-hmm.
So once you got to Dartmouth, how long did it take before you started, you know, making your own projects on Plato and creating your own, you know, original works? Or was it more like a collaborative sort of thing?
Well, first of all, I went to Cornell. Dartmouth was the time sharing system remotely.
Sorry, I got that mixed up.
That's okay. Well, I was definitely playing around on the local Cornell systems, mostly, at least for the first few years, I was taking as many computer science courses as I could. Cornell had a computer science department, but no computer science degree at the time. So I was doing math and computer science. I ended up getting my degree of all things in psychology. You know, in terms of messing around on Plato, I, you know, really got addicted to Plato, as did many people. And basically, in fact, it affected my grades significantly. The summer of 1977, I actually went to summer school in the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana, which is where Plato was located. That was where their central thing was, and basically messed around on Plato for the summer. It's where I wrote my first assembly language program. It's where I watched Star Wars. It's the year Star Wars came out. First show.
You went to the first showing? I went to showing. The
first show in Urbana of Star Wars, the matinee, and the place was a third empty.
Right. You know,
third full, something like that, because nobody had any clue.
Yeah, I've heard it took a while for that to kind of catch on. But being a space fan, I'm assuming you were keyed in.
Well, I was a science fiction fan.
Right, right.
But if you've ever seen the original trailer for Star Wars that came, you've seen it. It's awful, isn't it?
It's terrible. I would not go see that movie.
Yeah, it's like, so we basically only hardcore science fiction fans went to the first show. But the story I tell about it is that, you know, so like we're just sitting in there and then, you know, that the little blockade runner comes over and we go, wow, that's actually really cool. And then the Star Destroyer comes over, and, you know, draws dropping us. Holy fuck.
Okay. I mean, don't go full blue.
Okay. All right.
The occasional obscenity is okay.
So, at the end of the first show, basically everybody pretty much ran out and formed two lines. One was at the box office to get tickets to see it again. The other was at the payphones. Remember those things? Mm-hmm. It was the payphones to like call people up and say, you have to come and see this movie. And then like by the evening shows, it was lines around the block.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So that was kind of a little bit of a digression.
But
that's okay.
You cannot nerd out about Star Wars and Star Trek.
I mean, Star Wars was one of the first movies I ever saw. I saw it, you know, when it re-entered theaters, I think, in the early 80s, and they added Episode 4. Like, I saw it in a drive-through with my parents when I was maybe like 4 years old, 5 years old. And I still remember, you know, vague little flashes of that drive-through or drive-in theater screen and the Jawa Sandcrawler and that sort of thing. Like, kind of a very memorable formative experience there.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's why I'm here right now talking to you. Yeah. So you said that you started messing around with Plato stuff and I don't think we actually got to the point where you were creating your own programs.
No, I wouldn't say I was creating my own programs. I was definitely experimenting with stuff. I was seeing what other people were doing and wondering, like, how the heck did they do that? But although I was programming at that time, and I was, you know, stumbling around trying to learn the craft, I wouldn't say that I was doing anything really significant. I was more of a player. You know, I was definitely, you know, wanting to learn things, and, you know, making some stumbling first steps, but I don't think I really became a real games programmer, other than just doing some simple experiments, until personal computers came out.
Mm. So what was the first personal computer that you owned, or at least had access to on a regular basis?
I had a TRS-80.
Okay.
I was actually at the time working at one of the first computer stores, Computerland in Ithaca, writing accounting software, mm-hmm. business software for them. And I really wanted an Apple II, but I couldn't afford one. So when I was home at Christmas, I think maybe like junior year, there was a local Radio Shack that had a TRS-80, and they didn't know what to do with it. And they didn't really want it because it was like taking up space. And so I got it at a really good price. And when I got back to college, I proudly told my boss I had gotten a computer, that I'd gotten a TRS-80, and he fired me. He likened it to a Ford salesman driving into work in a Chevy. I actually got a job within like a few days at the college doing computer programming for a really wonderful professor, and of all places, the hotel school. Hmm. It turned out the hotel school was doing a lot of pretty innovative work in computers because hotels mm-hmm. were one of the first industries to really start using right. computers big time. Mm-hmm. And so he was doing a lot of research on computer systems for hotels. And I got a job with him for more money, which was especially sweet, being a teaching assistant for him.
Okay, so basically once you had your TRS-80, then you pretty much had open access to, you know, computing. I'm assuming before that it was, you know, shared systems and that sort of thing. So
yeah, I had it in my dorm room.
Right. So I feel like that probably opened up a lot of horizons.
Yeah, I mean, I started doing my own implementations of some of the classic games. I started thinking about, like, how could I do some of the Play-Doh games on this dinky little computer? Like, you know, how would that style of game work on a TRS-80, a home computer? I ended up, the first professional product I released was a little tape that had 15 games for $15. And it was basically TRS-80 implementations of all the classics, you know, Mugwump, and I think there was a Reversi game in there and stuff like that. And that actually, sold a few copies. I was very surprised. I thought maybe I'd sell like two or three of them. Mm-hmm. I think I sold a couple of hundred. That's great.
In terms of like capabilities, how much were you scaling down the Plato system to fit onto TRS-80? Like, what's the ratio? Are we talking orders of magnitude here?
Well, it's complicated because Plato was a shared system. Mm-hmm. I would say you had much less memory and resources, but probably equivalent amounts of computational power. You didn't have the graphics that Plato had. Plato, 512 by 512 pixels. Nobody saw that again until, the Mac.
Right.
I mean, it literally, actually, the Mac was only 512 by 342.
Yeah.
It was
half that size or half the vertical resolution.
So there were definite limitations. And of course, the big thing was that in Plato, you could do multiplayer. I mean, it had this natural way of allowing different people to share memory inside the same program. Mm-hmm. They had a thing called common memory, which was common to everybody, and everybody could read and write it. And the other cute thing they did was the way the time sharing was done. There was a very natural and easy way to basically do semaphores. You could guarantee exclusive access to particular bits of memory. I have a sneaking suspicion that many of the improvements in Plato that were done during the early 70s were done basically because some guy who's writing a game needed it, and he went and talked to the system programmers and said, it'd be really nice. And the system programmers, of course, all playing the games, would then go and implement it.
Mm-hmm. So how did you go from converting, Reversi and Hunt the Wumpus to TRS-80 to Wizardry? Like, what's the chain of evolution there? And how do you go from, point A to point B?
Well, at the end of the first semester of my senior year, Cornell asked if I might want to take a little time off because of low grades.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, they were pretty firm about it. Which you can imagine, my mother was not amused. So I had to spend the next year sleeping on my mom's couch. Now, my father had died just before I went to college. And he had an industrial company that produced resin-coated sand, which is an industrial material that's used to make the molds for which molten metal is poured in to make castings. And my mother took over the business and brought in a partner, a guy named Fred Siratak. And Fred had another business that produced these little it was called commemorative gifts, and they produced spoons and other things that were like engraved, the handles were engraved, things like that. And he decided he needed to computerize his inventory because they had like hundreds of different spoons they had to keep track of. And so my mother volunteered me for the job of doing this since I was sitting, I was lying on her couch all day long, feeling very sorry for myself. So we went off and got an Apple II. And we got an Apple II. It had the memory card, so it had 64K. We got the Pascal because I was familiar with Pascal from Cornell because Pascal was used there. A couple of disk drives. And so I set to work doing this inventory system for him. And in my spare time, of course, I've now got a computer, another computer. So I start messing around with experimenting with the games. And the first thing I did was I started playing around with data structures to learn a little bit more about the Pascal implementation. I ended up producing this kind of tree structured database program called InfoTree, which we ended up calling InfoTree. And so Fred had two sons, Rob and Norm. And somehow they found out I was doing this, and somebody had the idea, like, why don't we try and sell this? So we ended up selling, you know, in the little Ziploc bag type of thing, the database program, and actually sold, again, you know, several hundred copies, which, you know, I was very surprised. And then somebody had the idea of doing a game, because they, you know, the games had started to come out for the Apple II, and, you know, after hours, a lot of the computer time on the Apple II was being used for them, and said, well, why can't we do this? I don't for the life of me remember whose idea it was. So I started thinking about it, and, I thought, like, you know, what game do I want to write? I'd like to write a space game. And one of my favorite games on Play-Doh was a game called Empire, which is just like one of the most amazing games ever done. I mean, to my mind, it still to this day holds up. It's a tremendous tactical, strategic space war game, multiplayer. And I love that game. So I thought to myself, how could you ever do this on like this little dinky Apple II? And I started playing around with it, learning how the graphics worked. And, I realized I couldn't do a multiplayer game, so I need to do a single player game. I said to myself, well, if this was a single player game, you know, how would you do it? You know, you would either have to be attacking or defending. And I came up with, and so that out of that idea, the sort of basic idea of what became Galactic Attack came out. So I tried to adapt what I'd seen that had worked on Play-Doh. And I had to add things like it. If one of the players is a computer, you got to have some sort of AI. So I had to come up with a crude AI that would like try to play a reasonable game, and just see how much you could do within the limitations of the machine. And so that's where that came from. And so we started selling that, and it actually started selling fairly well. 1,000 copies in like the first few months, if I recall correctly. And again, this was kind of a Ziploc thing. So Rob and Norm come to me and they say, well, you know, what's next? And so I started thinking about it. And one of the other things that had caused me to get thrown out of Cornell was playing too much D&D.
Okay.
Way too much D&D. We had a huge D&D club at Cornell that would basically play from Friday evening till Sunday evening nonstop.
So this was like first edition stuff, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah. This was the original White Pigs. And there obviously had been dungeon games on Play-Doh. So I started thinking about how a game would you do this on the limited resources you had available on the Apple II, and how would you deal with the single player aspects? Because the thing that was great about the Play-Doh games was that you could join with a bunch of your friends and go down and beat on the monsters, and you couldn't. How could you? You can't do that on the little single player Apple II. And so I started writing a game. I started, you know, fleshing out some ideas. And that game, my working title for it was Paladin. And then, completely by accident, I honestly don't remember what the chain of events was. I heard that somebody I knew from Cornell, Andy Greenberg, who was also a Play-Doh person, was also working on doing a kind of D&D type game on the Apple II. And we got in contact with each other and started talking about it. And it turned out he was further along in the project than I was. He had actually written a game in AppleSoft Basic that had a lot of the core design features that Wizardry later used. And he had one thing that turned out to be probably the most important thing. He had the name Wizardry. And as soon as he told me what the name was, I go like, that is an awesome name. And he also had a very interesting resource. He had a bunch of friends who were avid gamers who would play the game and tell him everything that sucked about it.
There's something very important about that kind of focus group.
Yeah. Well, we decided that it made sense for us to kind of join forces, because I had the time to do the programming and he had the time to do the design and he had his friends to do the testing. Okay. So we kind of did beta testing before there was beta testing. So we made a deal to split up any money that might come from this. And we started working on the game. We got together, we fleshed out a design. I went back and started writing database editors to edit the dungeons and things like that. And he started thinking about the kind of like events and stuff that would have to happen inside the game. And so basically over a period of about 18 months, we had a working version about 6 or 7 months after we started developing a working version in the fall of 80, maybe? Because we went to the Trenton Computer Festival. I think that's the first place we ever publicly showed it. And the game itself came out in, I think, September of 81. And so that's basically how that all kind of went together.
Mm-hmm. So kind of a two-man project with a very helpful pool of talented beta testers, as you say.
Yeah. They were called WARG, the Wizardry Advanced Research Group.
That's awesome. To know more about kind of how you adapted the idea of D&D into a computer game. You mentioned that the Plato games had a multiplayer component. And, you know, you look back at the early days of role-playing games on computers, and I feel like a lot of different people were sort of approaching the concept of, like, how do I D&D in a computer space when you lack, you know, the human element? And coming up with different solutions. Like, you know, Zork was very heavily inspired by the D&D experience, but that game doesn't really have combat. It has, you know, like the thief that you can pull the knife on, but that's pretty much it, or the sword on. It's really focused more on the story aspect. Whereas Wizardry, I feel like it's, you know, pretty much the exact opposite. It's there's a story there, but it's, you know, just kind of like to send you into the dungeon and then kind of let you go and develop your party and fight a lot of monsters and find treasures and, you know, eventually defeat the Mad Overlord.
Hack, hack, kill, kill, loot, loot, run,
basically.
Run.
So you know, it's like the two polar opposite aspects of the RPG. How did you, I'm curious to know how you went in that direction as opposed to more of a Zork direction, or, you know, something that was some sort of synthesis of the two, or if that was even possible given the limitations of computers back then.
I think a lot of that really comes down You know, most people don't want to admit it, but a lot of that sort of stuff really comes down to it seemed like a good idea at the time. We're all informed by our experiences. I mean, whenever you do anything like this, you basically take everything you've seen in, and learned in the past, and you just and now you have something new to apply it to, new technology, a new computer, whatever it is. And you just look at it and say, like, you know, well, you know, how can I take advantage of this particular environment in order to do things? So, you know, I've seen all these great games. I played them both on the computer and paper and pencil. I had all these experiences. So had Andy. And we're saying, like, okay, now we've got this new medium, you know, these little encapsulated computers. You know, how can we do cool, as cool a stuff as we think we can in this environment, you know, given these constraints, you know, and as the constraints change, you know, other people look at it and say, well, they did this, you know, now we have this, what can we do with this set of resources? So, in that aspect, you know, anything anybody does is basically just a link in a chain. Mm-hmm. There's this long chain, and it goes back way before D&D. It goes back to tabletop board gaming, mm-hmm. and before that, it was like military war gaming and Tolkien, mm-hmm. and Prince Caspian, and you know, all that sort of stuff. All of these things at any point in time, you know, people take all their influences and then they just sort of like do what they think is cool. And then other people see that and they say, like, well, I've got these new resources, or, you know, I can do better than that. And they try and do what they want to do. And it just goes off into the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, by no means am I being critical about the direction you went with Wizardry, because I think it's a valid interpretation. If you look at old D&D, some modules were very story driven, and some were just about go into the dungeon, fight monsters, avoid traps. And I feel like that's maybe the direction you went with that. But I'm curious if that reflects the experiences you had when you did tabletop gaming. If your sessions were more like about the adventure of it, the combat of it, or if it was more, you know, focused on the, like, talk to this guy and learn his story and that sort of thing.
I think we always wanted to do more and more story. Mm-hmm. The original games, you know, each game, I worked on the first four Wizardry games, mm-hmm. and each game in the series we tried to do something a little bit new, adding little story elements and tried to make that aspect of it richer within the context of the game engine, because we were really pushing the limits of what an Apple II could do. I mean, we were swapping things in and off disk, mm-hmm. like crazy. You actually had to flip the disc when you played it, and that was so that we could put the database for the game in the same place as the operating system was on the other side of the disc. Mm-hmm. All sorts of really bizarre little tricks like that. But, you know, we were definitely always trying to add sort of to make the game have new aspects to it, in particular story. I mean, which is why, for example, Wizardry 4, the entire premise of the game was flipped. Right. Now you're the bad guy, and that game is really a puzzle game.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was, you know, our attempt to play with that aspect of the experience.
Okay. So obviously, you know, in turning the tabletop role-playing concept into a video game, you didn't want to just copy D&D. You wanted to bring your own ideas to it. Can you talk about how you sort of developed systems and mechanics and, you know, spell classes and things like that? I mean, was that mostly your partner, or was that kind of a collaborative effort? I'm curious to know, like, you know, Wizardry, I think, is a very distinct game from D&D. So I'm sure there was a creative process there that I'm curious to know more about, if you think it's anything worth talking about.
I think that the previous games had given us a basic structure, things that worked, things that didn't work. Then the problem really was, you know, how can you do these things efficiently? Mm-hmm. Efficiently, you know, it's a resource problem. So given the constraints you're working under, you know, what game systems are the most important? What things do you kind of have to fake? Because, you have to kind of cheat a little bit to get done. And what aspects of the environment allow you to do things that you mightn't give you a solution that that makes your life a lot easier. For example, in Wizardry, the spell names seem to have a kind of a syntax to them. Mm-hmm. That was done as a bit of a storytelling aspect. We eventually ended up telling people that a lot of these names, especially place names and things like that in Wizardry, are all mock Welsh. Why? I have no idea. They just sound Welsh. They just ended up sounding Welsh. Too many consonants.
Lots of double L's at the beginning.
Yeah, yeah. But so, for example, Andy came up with this syntax for the spell names. And when you type in a spell name, the computer has to recognize which spell you're casting. And this actually turned out to be a problem because, you know, literally having the strings for all the spell names was taking up too much memory. I mean, it's only about 500 bytes, mm-hmm. but 500 bytes was precious. So what we ended up doing was inside in the code, we didn't store the spell names. We had a little hashing algorithm, a really dumb hashing algorithm, that would reduce whatever you typed into when you're entering a spell name to cast it, whatever you typed in, it would just hash it to a single 16-bit integer, and then we just compare that, which ended up saving us 300 bytes. Only problem was I didn't have any resources for good hashing algorithms. And the hashing algorithm I came up with on my own was really bad. And there was no matter what, you know, levers and dials I pushed, because I had to get this done like in an afternoon, no matter what dials and levers I pushed, I couldn't get it to come up with the unique numbers for each spell. It was always a hash collision. We ended up taking the easy way out, which was that we changed one of the spell names so that it wasn't in the regular thing. I forget which one it was, but there's one of these progressions of spell names where one of them just like is not what you would quite expect it to be. And that is solely so that it would not collide in the hash algorithm.
That's really interesting. But yeah, those technical limitations really affected these early games. You know, people were making for things like Apple II and TRS-80. And I feel like a lot of creativity and a lot of iconic elements came out of that. I mean, you talk about the syntax of spells. Like, you look at pretty much any Japanese RPG that's come along, and they have something very similar, like the Dragon Quest games. They have like a progressive naming system for each of their spells. Final Fantasy, like the ice magic is Blizzard, Blizzara, Blizzaga. So you know there's like there, you know, there's that same mm-hmm. sort of syntactic logic that you introduced, and it became just something that people do with RPG spells. So that's you know, it's interesting to know how iconic
it's
elements and right, like these things came about for a certain reason. You know, like a practical limitation, but they've been adopted as just
yeah.
Like
there's a
how
word. It's on the tip of my tongue. There's a word for things like that, for technological things like that, that have just you know, kind of ossified and become something that everybody does, even though there's no longer any real advantage to it. At the time, there was.
Right.
Now there isn't. But it's still sort of, there's such an installed base of users and expectation that that everybody, that's the sort of default solution now.
No matter who you are, brushing your teeth is one of the most important parts of your day to stay healthy. Quip knows that. And their team of dentists and designers is focused on helping you take care of your mouth better. Quip is an electric toothbrush that costs a fraction of bulkier brushes, but still packs just the right amount of vibrations to help clean your teeth. Quip has a built-in timer to help you clean the dentist's recommended way. And they offer new brush heads on a dentist's recommended schedule every 3 months for just $5, including free shipping worldwide. With Quip, you don't have to worry about getting new brush heads or toothpaste. They're delivered right to your door on schedule. So you replace your brush on time and have better oral hygiene at an affordable price. It's not just for convenience, it's for your health, too. Quip has appeared on Oprah's O-List, was named one of Time's Best Inventions, and is the first subscription electric toothbrush accepted by the American Dental Association. Quip starts at just $25, and if you go to getquip.com/retro right now, you'll get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/retro. getquip.com/retro. Pluto TV is the leading free streaming television service. Watch more than 100 TV channels and thousands of movies on demand, all for free. No credit card needed and no sign up. Pluto TV is the easy and completely legal way to watch your favorite TV shows and hit movies. What are you waiting for? Never pay for TV again. Download Pluto TV for free on all your favorite devices today.
I want to take a minute and talk about underwear. Yes, underwear. Everybody needs it, and new is better than old. And they have to be comfortable, so you should get some MeUndies. Folks, I know what you're saying, Bob. You keep bothering us about underwear every week. You know what? I've made it my mission in life that every listener out there will be comfortable in their groinal regions with a nice pair of MeUndies underpants. And if you like high-pressure sales tactics, I have an offer for you, a no-risk offer. If you're not happy, MeUndies will refund the cost, and you get to keep them. And because you're listening to Retronauts, you'll get 15% off your first pair and free shipping. If that sounds good to you, go to MeUndies.com/retro. That's MeUndies.com/retro. And here's an extra gift for you. Order a pair, take a screenshot of your transaction, and send it to me, and I'll send you another pair. And by I mean MeUndies, because I'm not going to be sending you people underwear. I have better things to do. You get one for 15% off and another pair from me for free, and by me I mean MeUndies. I can't stress that enough. The first 25 people to send a proof of purchase, a screenshot of your purchase or of the receipt, I'll send you another pair free. Again, I mean MeUndies. The company MeUndies will send you the underwear. I will not be touching them in any way. Just send your proof to gift@podcastone.com and put retro in the subject line, and you will soon have another pair in your collection. Let's do this. MeUndies.com/retro.
If you're a fan of Retronauts, you're probably a fan of pro wrestling. Check out the Steve Austin Show each Tuesday and Thursday, exclusively on Podcast One. Join the Pro Wrestling Hall of Famer and action movie star as he shares tales from his new life, unbelievable past adventures, and covers all the happenings in the pro wrestling world. So don't miss the Steve Austin Show each week on Podcast One. And remember to rate and review.
Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive's Employee of the Month, 2 months in a row. Leave a message at the... Hi, Jamie. It's me, Jamie. I just had a new idea for our song about the Name Your Price tool. So when it's like, tell us what you want to pay, hey, 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 and the trombone goes, blah, 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 and you say, we'll help you find coverage options to fit your budget. Then we just all do finger snaps while a choir goes, savings coming at ya, savings coming at ya. Yes? No? Maybe? Anyway, see you at practice tonight. I got new lyrics for the rap break.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
So Wizardry is a 10-level dungeon, and you create a party of
six
characters. Okay. So, you know, that's, you know, by I think modern standards, that's a fairly compact game, but obviously it was meant to be played for a very long time. So I'm curious about, you know, working with the beta testers you had, the wargs, how did you find the right balance of like difficulty and challenge? And like, at what point did you say, okay, that's too frustrating, we have to dial it back? You know, things like having to go back to town to be able to save, and, you know, characters in the back row not being able to attack with short ranged weapons and that sort of thing. Like, how did you fine tune that? Was it just a long, laborious process?
Well, some of those things were just technological limitations. Like, the reason you had to go back to the town to save was that we couldn't layer in the save code to the other areas of the game. We would run out of space, or the particular way we were having to interleave things on and off disk in particular segments of code, they kind of stack up. So you have the base core code, and then on top of that, say a module like the town could get loaded in. And when you went into the dungeon, the town stuff just got discarded and it loaded in from disk the core dungeon code. But then when you got into a combat, it would then throw that away, bring in the combat code, and then when you were actually fighting, it would actually load in sublevels. That's why there was a lot of disk activity when you were actually fighting, was because there was like one sublayer for physical attacks, there was a sublayer for spell attacks. Okay. And that was solely because we were so limited on the amount of memory that we had to do this kind of interleaving. But in order to add like the feature of being able to save in game, apart from actually having to store that information somewhere of like where you are, it would mean we would have to write another segment of code that we'd bring in. And not only would we have problems with space in memory, we'd also have problems with space on disk. We had 280 512 byte sectors accessible on disk. And that had to store, even with the disk flipping thing that we were doing, that had to store the entire program and all of the data for the game and the save game data. And we used every single sector in the final Wizardry game. I mean, there was absolutely nothing left over. And adding a line of code that caused one part of the program to become one block bigger would break the entire game. Mm-hmm. We didn't have the space for it. Mm. And so it was a continual battle. You know, adding a level would have added two blocks. It's about 1K. So 10 levels. Why was it 10 levels? Because that's how many levels we thought we could get away with.
Mm-hmm. So were there elements that you had to remove from the game that you really, you know, wanted there just for space reasons? And also, you know, the game is sort of infamously difficult, and it doesn't seem like it's afraid to really challenge you with things like teleporter mazes and things like that. But were there things that were just too hard and the wargs were like, you've got to dial this back?
Yeah, well, there were definitely things that we actually had in the code at one point that we ended up taking out. You know, the little kind of cameo encounters. If I recall correctly, there was a cameo encounter you would get at one point where you basically ran into Thundar the Barbarian, who was a cartoon character, that I don't think it ever made it into the final game, or it may have actually been still in the database, but it was disabled and we would never get it. And there were definitely things, you know, things we wanted to do that we ended up saying, okay, we just, like, we don't have the code space for this, so we can't do it. But the balancing was mostly doing things like making sure that there was a fairly steady progression of encounter difficulty as you went deeper in the dungeon. Mm-hmm. And we actually had encounter tables and stuff for figuring that out so that you would occasionally get like a really tough encounter, but those would be fairly rare. And you would be able to calibrate your risk in terms of, like, if you pushed it too hard, you would occasionally get an encounter that was just going to wipe you. But if you were cautious and played conservatively, that would be very, very unlikely. So it was all that sort of risk reward type of thing, I think is something that actually leverages the players as much as it does the game, in that you, it allowed players to sort of pick their level of challenge. I mean, we weren't thinking about, like, you know, having a dial in the game that let you turn up and down the difficulty. You know, that would have been way too advanced for us back in the day. But you could definitely, by the way you play the game, calibrate that stuff. Stuff like, you know, the three people in the front are in physical contact and the people in the back are a bit protected but can't attack physically. That's pretty standard out of wargaming. So, you know, that once we came up with the idea of, like, well, how do we do this multiplayer thing? Well, we can't give you multiple players, but we can give you multiple characters. So that's our attempt to bring that kind of social aspect into it. Then that kind of thing becomes a very natural thing to do. And we didn't realize it at the time. We thought that pretty much everybody would be just playing this by themselves, but it did turn out that a fair number of people would play socially, which was not something we kind of expected, but did turn out to be kind of an interesting byproduct of the design. I don't think it was intended, but it was a nice sort of unintended consequence.
Yeah, you know what you mentioned about part about the sort of player calibrated difficulty level, the risk reward, I think. Was that something that you had, like, you picked up from other games, or was that something that you guys intuited yourself? Because that is a core component of so many RPGs, like computer RPGs and console RPGs now. The idea that you kind of build your own difficulty. Like the further you range a field, you can get greater, you know, benefits
from
it. But
that's really standard in any D&D campaign. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I was playing D&D back at Cornell. I started doing a little bit of GMing in the big Cornell campaign. That sort of stuff. I mean, everybody knows the deeper you go in the dungeon, the nastier the monsters are.
Right, right. Yeah, obviously, like the idea that, you know, you go to the new floor, you're going to find nastier monsters. But I mean, even like within the same floor, within one foray into the dungeon, the longer you spend there, the more likely you are to come up across something that's just going to like wipe you out. But, you know, do you want to keep going and keep cultivating more experience?
Because it's going to take you time to get back.
Yeah, and you haven't used up all your resources yet. You can still go a little further. So it kind of creates that a sense of risk there. Like, I can keep going and I can really benefit from it, but is it worth the possible downsides?
I think that sort of stuff is a natural consequence of the sort of genre and type of the game, the fact that flows out of the fact that you're a certain distance away from safety. Mm-hmm. And actually, one of the things I've always found quite interesting about when people talk to me about how much they enjoyed playing the game was almost invariably have a story about they were having this great expedition and they got all this great loot and they're running back and like three steps away from town, they hit an encounter and it's like, no.
Yeah.
And if I had known that, we would have probably twisted up so that there was a slightly higher chance of getting an encounter when you head back towards town, because that turned out to be such an emotional experience for people. But it's completely an unintended consequence of just like the physical structure of the game. Mm-hmm. Almost all of these things especially back in the day, we just had no idea what we were doing. We were informed a little bit by the things we had done, but there wasn't this body of experience. So every, you know, what we were doing in Wizardry, what Richard was doing in Acalabeth and Ultima, they're all, we're all just kind of blindly stumbling around trying to, you know, figure out what works and what doesn't. And, you know, some things worked and some things didn't. And we basically, you know, a lot of people who were trying to do these kind of games, and I think we basically got lucky. We made some good decisions, but we also lucked out in a lot of ways. I mean, that's one thing that, as I've become older, I've come to realize just how big a part just pure blind chance and circumstances have in the course of a project or even a life. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I hadn't gone to Cornell, if that librarian hadn't brought that book into the library, if I hadn't gone to the right college, if I hadn't had the right teachers, if Cornell didn't have Plato terminals, you know, if Star Wars hadn't come out, I wouldn't be here talking to you. I wouldn't be married to my wife, who I met because she was my interpreter mm-hmm. when Animago was getting started up. Hmm. And the only reason I met her was because she was hired by a Japanese friend who ran a Japanese software company. Okay. And so, like, all these things are like pure chance. And I think that's that, not to wax too philosophical, but I kind of feel that whenever you talk about successes in your life, you have to do it with a certain amount of humility, because you're often just by pure chance in like the top 5% of possible outcomes that could have happened. And you just, you know, lucked out. And there's a lot of other people who were working just as hard or just as smart and just as talented back at that time, that the circumstances came out in a totally different way. So you have to take everything with a kind of a grain of salt and not kind of like think you're that hot shit, because it turns out you're probably not. or at least you're not, your shit isn't hotter than most people's.
Right. So I totally agree with that. Since we're, you know, kind of on a philosophical tangent, to kind of bring it back just a little bit, let me ask kind of like the biggest question on my list here, which is, what do you think makes a great role-playing game?
Oh my goodness. At its core, I think it has to provide really significant emotional experiences. And it has to allow you to project yourself into the characters in the game. I think you see this in the really best games. You know, you're carried along in the story with this character, but you can empathize with them. You get a chance to make decisions that, like, how you would be if you were in that situation. So it's a projective thing. So I think that the really great games are the ones that find maybe some new or better or interesting twist on how to do that. Recent examples, Fallout 4, and especially Witcher, The Wild Hunt. I mean, I actually don't play a huge amount of games. I'm literally just too busy. But the types of games I generally play are kind of like building games, construction games. But because they, especially games where I can actually implement a computer inside of the game. Mm-hmm. For some reason, I have just a great love of doing that. But when it comes to role-playing games, the ones that have captured my attention are the ones that provide that kind of emotional journey experience, where you can play through Fallout as a complete and utter bastard, or you can play through Fallout as trying to be as empathic as you can. And same thing goes with Witcher. And so I think that is the important core aspect of them. I think that's really basically what the game is all about.
Mm-hmm. Do you think you can still have those emotional experiences without a strong narrative, you know, just from the emergent gameplay that comes out of the games? Or do you think games should be looking deeper than that these days?
I don't know if I'm the right person to ask. I can only speak to my own personal experience there, which is that I like games that challenge me on a philosophical and emotional level, at least in terms of like the role-playing games, because they are projective.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you're going to be doing a role-playing game, you want your players to be able to role-play. So I think that sort of kind of goes hand in glove I don't think you can write a good role-playing game without being able to do that.
Hmm. Okay. Interesting.
Not that I understood that at the time, mind you.
But no, I mean, what you created has become a cornerstone of the genre, and, you know, people build on top of that and take that as inspiration and, you know, have been able to find ways to balance the deep sort of combat there with the more story-driven puzzles and things like that that you saw in games like Zork. So, you know, it's an evolutionary process.
I wouldn't say cornerstone. I'd say just link in the chain.
Hmm.
Or maybe like link in the chain mail.
Okay, nice.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because really, it's everything depends on the past and informs the future. So, I mean, I think, you know, people will 20 years from now look back at Witcher and say, boy, wow, that really charted the course. But if you look at the broader perspective, where Witcher came from and all the things that were going on in the industry around the same time, I think it's a much more nuanced story.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't disagree that, you know, no one comes up with the first idea. There's always, you're always taking something from the past. But I do feel like, you know, Wizardry is a milestone in that it took all these ideas and processed them into something that works in a computer context. And it like, I still see its influences in so many games today. And not just like a vague influence, but one of my favorite series is a series called Etrian Odyssey, which is very, very much in the vein of Wizardry. Like, it's, you know, pretty light on story, very heavy on the exploration. You go into the dungeon. It's on Nintendo DS or 3DS, so you use the bottom screen, the touch screen, to draw the actual map instead of having to use graph paper. But it still has, you know, the first person dungeon exploration and turn-based combat, and you know, you roll your own characters from set classes and that sort of thing. So, you know, people are still taking, you know, the ideas that you laid down 35 years ago and saying, like, how can we spin this into something new and create something original out of this while still being very true to, you know, to the ideas that came along before. I'm not trying to like puff you up or anything like that. Just like, you know, I've talked to so many game developers, RPG developers, especially in Japan, who cite wizardry as a huge influence, like Yuji Horii, who designed Dragon Quest, and Akitoshi Kawazu, who created the Saga series, and let's see, who else? Koichi Nakamura, who helped work on Dragon Quest and then created the Mystery Dungeon series of roguelikes. Like, all of them have cited wizardry. Like, they imported the game before it was even localized into Japanese. You know, they saw it at like Macworld or something and were just like, this is amazing. I need this in my life. So they imported it and, you know, stumbled through a game in a foreign language that was all just text, and they loved
it. Fortunately, not too much. I didn't have the bytes for it.
No, that's true. But still, like, you know, it was a game in a foreign language that was probably a little alien to them and a little challenging in that respect, but it really spoke to them and it influenced them, and the games that they created out of it, like Dragon Quest and Mystery Dungeon and Final Fantasy and so forth. Like, these are still pillars of the games industry right now. They're games that you can go buy the latest sequel. And all of them were inspired in some way, you know, to some degree by wizardry and the wizardry trilogy, I think.
Well, there could be an argument made that's just a founder effect, in that wizardry was just wizardry and Ultima just happened to be the games that were able to literally jump across the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. A lot of the stuff that was going on in the D&D, you know, tabletop gaming, much of that, you know, would need, because of all of its text, would need to be localized. So that was delayed. They didn't have access to Plato. So and they didn't have access to a lot of like what was going on in the sort of homebrew computer industry. So what happened was there were, you know, several games that became popular in the US that, for which, you know, they did jump over. And then, of course, when you have a founder couple in a new ecosystem that's completely unexploited, they explosively radiate.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, what the original, you know, species was, is pure random. Okay. And it probably, there's just like one guy in Japan who noticed wizardry and imported it and told his friends. Yeah. I have no idea who that is. I'd like to thank him. he has no idea who he is, probably. But that kind of, you know, caused this thing to spread out. And again, pure luck.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I will say that in terms of wizardry success in Japan, a huge amount of credit has to go to the people who worked at a company called Fortune that did the original localization of wizardry. In fact, that's one of the reasons I started going to Japan was to help them with that localization. And some of the tricks we had to do in order to get wizardry to run on all these different machines. We turned all of these different Japanese machines into Apple IIs.
Okay. They all, like a virtual machine?
Yeah. They all, wizardry was written in Pascal, which runs under a P-code interpreter. And so they wrote P-code interpreters for all these different architectures. And that's how we did wizardry on the PC here and the Commodore here. It was all done by writing P-code interpreters. And the other thing that they helped me figure out was like how to do localization into foreign languages. So like by the time the Japanese wizardry came out, we had moved all of the text in the game into a database and it actually constructed things using templates and grammar strings. we actually had code in the game that, that would decide whether or not, for example, to say a something or an something, you know, and we had modules like that to support all the different languages. So that's how the localization into Japanese was done. And then later the German and French, and I think there were a couple others, but that was after my time. They just did an insane amount of work and sufficiently good that Wizardry 4, we actually didn't program that on an Apple. That was programmed on a NEC 90, PC 9801.
Really? Okay. I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
Interesting.
Because it was the fastest PC-like machine available at the time. So I would, you know, boot up into their MS-DOS clone and type in a magic command line, and suddenly I'd see, welcome to Apple Pascal, and I could program. I actually had to buy a copy of Apple Pascal to run on the 9801 because they had written the P-code interpreter, let it run. And it was like about 10 times faster than doing the same thing on a Mac.
Interesting. So that is something I wanted to ask you about is, you know, the kind of the way this game spread into Japan and became so influential over there and so popular. You really feel it's just, you know, kind of like circumstance, time and place. Do you think there's something within the game, like the style or the concept behind it that resonates with that audience? Or like, is it really just...
I really don't know. It's sort of a chicken and egg thing. Is it because Wizardry really appealed to them? Or was it because Wizardry was just the first one there and so everyone decided, well, that's how it should be done? I have no idea. You know, it's one of these situations where oftentimes there is no real answer to those questions. It's just the way it turned out. I mean, personally, I think the best version of the original Wizardry game ever done was the Nintendo.
Really? Interesting.
Because they, first of all, they managed to cram the entire game into a cartridge. And second of all, they leveraged the special graphics, you know, capabilities they had to make a really nice presentation, you know, really nice looking dungeons.
That was by ASCII. Did they do the conversion on that themselves?
Yeah, they did. And so they did, you know, all the people in Japan did just like tremendous work. I was really, really impressed by them.
It's interesting because there are still maybe four or five Japanese developers making games very much in the Wizardry mold. And you really don't see that here in the US, even with like in the indie games space. It's really hard to come across someone who's like, oh yeah, I gotta make a game like that. Even though, you know, it was a foundational game here, just as it was over there. But for some reason it's really kind of just stayed, you know, bubbling right beneath the surface over there. And it seems to still have a lot of followers, and a lot of them make it into English. And like, most of the Wizardry style games I've played have been from Japan and made, you know, within the past 10 or 15 years. So I don't know. It's just it's interesting to me, and it's always something I've wondered about because I hear it come up so much in my interviews with developers over there. It's just how much that game meant to them and how it was so inspirational.
I get maybe it was something as dumb as the fact that when we were writing Wizardry, the big TV show, the big TV event was Shogun. And so we kind of got into Japanese stuff. And so we put a few things in the game, you know, one of the character classes, and there's a particular blade, the Murasama blade. Actually, it should be Muramasa, but we typoed it by accident.
That blade gets misspelled in games a lot, actually.
Yeah, right. Probably because of us. So, you know, and we just put it in there because it kind of sounded cool. So maybe that was the reason. I have no idea.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. But, you know, that connection did eventually sort of lead you on your current path to Animago. How did that come across? Like, at what point did you realize, like, you know, I really want to get into bringing anime into America as opposed to making video games?
Well, the standard story I tell about this, which has the virtue of being absolutely true, is that I was working on Wizardry 4. I forget what I was actually working on at the time.
So like 87, 88-ish.
Yes, 89, late 88. Anyway, I had just gotten a video board for the Macintosh 2 called the ColorSpace 2, which did Genlock. It allowed you to put graphics on top of video. And I'd just gotten it to play around with it because I thought it was kind of a cool thing, you know. I get to have the company buy me a cool toy, right? Mm-hmm. And Roe Adams, who's the author of Wizardry 4, or the designer, he was a big anime fan. And we were living in Ithaca at the time, and so he was a member of the Cornell Japanese Animation Club. Mm-hmm. And back at this time, of course, there were no subtitle tapes. Basically, the way it worked is they would play a bootleg tape, a copy, 10th generation tape from Japan. And the one guy in the club who happened to speak Japanese would do a live translation.
Right.
Okay. Poor bastard. I know him too. He worked for Animago for several years. So he saw me playing around with this video board and he said, "Can you use that to put text on top of video?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, could you do subtitling?" And I said, "I don't see why not." And he says, "Well, we could subtitle some of these anime so that we can show them at my club and, you know, give them away." And I just thought about it for like 10 seconds and said, "Well, you know, I go to Japan all the time. I could go get some licenses and we could actually release this as a business." And 5 minutes later, when we had stopped laughing, and by laughing, I mean on the floor, can't breathe. What an incredibly stupid idea this is. It was sort of like, "Oh, why not?" And so that's how the company started. It was kind of a weekend, fun, stupid thing to do just because we could. And so we subtitled an anime as a test. It was something we later released called Vampire Princess Mew. Okay. And then we used that as a demo and managed to get a license for a title called Maddox, which we got that license from the US, from a Japanese trading company based in New York, because nobody in Japan wanted anything to do with us because, like, who are these crazy gaijin who want anime? Like, who subtitling anime? Like, that is the stupidest idea. And they were right. Obviously, it was a stupid idea. But then after that came out, I got a fax. This was back in the day when fax was important. Mm-hmm. From Toshio Okada, who was one of the founders of Gainax, which is the kind of the really cool animation studio in Japan that was started by fans. Mm-hmm. And they also were doing a lot of software and other things. And he said, "You know, I know you're trying to get some licenses, so tell you what, why don't you come over to Japan and be a guest at this computer convention we're doing? And if you do that for me, I will get you a bunch of appointments at all the anime companies." And so I said, "Okay, that sounds like a deal. Free trip to Japan, why not?" So I go, and he not only got me the appointments, he arranged my interpreter. So I ran around Tokyo all week with this young woman, Natsumi, and all we did was go to appointments and then, you know, kill time between appointments and stuff like that. I got to know her very well. At the end of the week, you know, I asked her to go out with me. We've been together ever since.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, so so even if Animago had completely crashed and burned, it would have been worth it for that. But a couple months later, I get another fax, from a company called Artmic. Apparently, they had gotten very drunk the night before and decided to give us a try. And that's how we got our first few titles, including Bubblegum Crisis, which is one of the classic anime titles.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the first anime I ever watched and pulled me in. I was like, this is crazy. This is awesome.
Yeah. So that's, again, you know, sequence of chances and little tiny things that led us to go and do that. And it ended up being something I've been doing for, you know, 25 years now.
Yeah, you've moved more to a Kickstarter model now. how has that been working out for you? I'm assuming pretty well because you keep doing them and I keep buying them. So, and you're bringing over the classics, which I really appreciate because those wouldn't otherwise be available here on Blu-ray, you know, high definition without those Kickstarters.
Well, we did that because after the Great Recession, we kind of downsized the company. And, you know, also I'm getting to the point where, you know, 10 years or so, I'm going to be retiring because I'm 59 now. And so we sort of wanted to just kind of scale back on the level of intensity. So what we came up with the idea of doing was using Kickstarter not as a funding method, but as a marketing and distribution tool. Because for these kind of special limited edition, very high quality box sets, it doesn't make sense to pay the Amazon tax of 40 or 50% to get distribution when you can go straight to the people who really want it. And it makes a lot of these projects viable. So it seemed like, again, you know, seemed like a good idea at the time. And we tried it out and it's been pretty successful. And quite frankly, they're a lot of fun to work on because you really get to nerd out on the details. And you also get something that I didn't really appreciate at the beginning, but I came to very quickly, was that because you're effectively working as doing a commission for a group of patrons, you can tailor that to exactly what they want. And you can work, you get to involve them in the design decisions and, so you give them an emotional experience the way I like to explain it is that the essential problem in the digital media field is that anybody can copy a Disney movie. You know, bits are bits. They're easy to copy. But nobody can copy a trip to Disneyland. So what we're trying to do in these projects is provide not only the movie, but the trip in terms of like, you get to see us make all these horrible mistakes and like, you know, help us make the decisions. Like, you know, do you like this layout better than this? You know, what special features would you like? Things like that. And in fact, we've actually let some people actually work on the projects and it turned out that, you know, every time we've done that, it's like one or two people have turned out to be like so incredibly good that we now just are hiring them professionally to do it for us. You know, that first project basically became their portfolio, and now they're professionals and they're doing it for not just us but for other people, which I think is kind of cool. That was, again, something completely unexpected that came out of it, was that it would provide people with kind of their intro into this, well, I don't know if I should call it an industry, but into this particular strange profession.
Okay. And you're about to launch a Gunsmith Cats Kickstarter. That was like an OAV series, right?
Yeah, three episodes, OVA, back in the mid-90s. For some reason, and it literally is, again, pure chance, all of the ones we've done so far have been shows that had Kenichi Sonoda heavily involved in them, like a character designer or character designer and writer.
Was he involved with Otaku no Video?
Yes.
Okay.
He did some of the character designs.
Okay.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I definitely know he was Bubblegum Crisis and Writing Bean and Gunsmith Cats.
Yeah.
But yeah, that is an interesting coincidence. So I assume you know him pretty well at this point.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like your buds.
Natsumi just went off to Japan this morning, as we record this, and, this weekend, she's going to be going out to coffee with Sonoda to check on the details. He's going to be doing a couple of cool things for this new project. So to check in with him, and he's a really interesting character.
I'm sure his work has some very interesting idiosyncrasies. Lots of cars and lots of guns.
Yeah, in fact, he's. It just came out yesterday. He is going to Anime Central, which mm-hmm. is a convention in Chicago.
Okay.
In May, I think I'm going to say May 20th ish, but I'm not quite sure. Because they just announced they're going to be premiering a new Gunsmith Cats short film.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. And I'm sure that he is going to take the chance to go to a couple of gun ranges and shoot off some very big guns.
I'm going to wind this interview down now because it's been an hour and a half. But before I wrap it up, I did have a couple of questions that some listeners sent in to direct to you. So if you don't mind answering a couple of those.
Sure.
Okay, great. The first one is from David Langley, who says, Wizardry 4 is fascinating both in how much of a tonal and structural shift it made from the first three games and its celebration of your fans by placing their parties in the game. What made you want to implement these ideas?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I think it all stems from the core idea, which is to completely reverse the game. In other words, make you the villain, or at least you the person, the antagonist of the original games. And once you do that, these become sort of natural decisions. That choice and the choice to make it a puzzle game really informs a lot of the decisions. And in terms of letting actual players' characters be the teams in the game, that we basically did because it saved us time. Everybody else could build up characters for us and teams. And all we had to do was write a little code that could basically analyze and roughly grade those teams in terms of how powerful they mm-hmm. were. And then you can just plug them right in where we need them.
So a little bit of... logical evolution and a little bit of pragmatism.
Yeah, I mean, and as with so many things, it just seemed like a cool idea at the time.
Mm-hmm. All right, from Juan Gutierrez, he writes a little paragraph here and then has a bunch of questions. I'll kind of pare it down. Despite not liking dungeon crawlers, I'm quite interested in Wizardry's influence in the development of RPGs, particularly Japanese RPGs, starting with Yuji Horii's visit to America, where he saw Wizardry and other early RPGs that led him to develop Portopia and Dragon Quest, which in turn helped pave the way for future JRPGs. The popularity of the genre in Japan seems to have come in part from Wizardry. So that's kind of reinforcing some of the things mm-hmm. that I was saying. So he wants to know, let's see, which is your favorite game of the series?
Oh, that is a difficult question. I would say that this is sort of a situation of once you know how sausage is made, you never want to eat it again. in that... when you start writing one of these, you think, oh, this is going to be the coolest one you've ever done, stuff like that. And when you finally get through the death march of finishing it, it's like, this is the one you hate the most. So I think... to use a Star Wars analogy, most people would say that, and I would agree, that The Empire Strikes Back is the best, but you can't compare it to A New Hope because it was the first.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it exists on a different plane. It's really not comparable. So I enjoyed the first one the most because that was the one where we were struggling with all of the real technical, you know, just details of like, how the hell do we do this in terms of getting the core game to work? I enjoyed the fourth one most in terms of that was the one that was the greatest struggle in order to tell the story that we wanted to tell, which is why it was so late. There was about a year when I was seriously convinced that it would be ready. I would have it finished in a week. For an entire year, I was like, it'll be ready next week. I'll be done with this next week. And it kept being like, no, we kept running into these roadblocks. So it was very frustrating to do, but it's the one that, you know, I felt it was the one where we got to do the most kind of different things in the game. At the same time, I think it's probably the least accessible of the games.
Mm.
Just because it's so focused. So it was really designed to be like for the expert and to be really hard. Some people would say too hard, and I think that's a valid thing. I mean, because again, we were struggling and, you know, kind of blindly looking around for like, you know, what is the right level of difficulty? What is the balance? What makes a puzzle too difficult or not difficult enough? And you learn by making mistakes.
Well, finally, from Ben Elgin, are you going to get Macross 7 released over here once Harmony Gold's dang Robotech license finally expires? A question many of us would love a happy answer to.
Yeah. I have a standard answer to questions like this. If you've ever seen me at a convention, you'll know it. But for the benefit of those people who haven't, the answer is, I will neither confirm nor deny the confirmation or denial of our licensing plans. I will neither further confirm nor deny the existence of Japan, Japanese animation, or our company.
So, sorry, Ben.
Yeah, I mean, the answer is, who the hell knows? If the opportunity, there are tons of shows that if the opportunity presents itself to do a new release, I would definitely do it. And, you know, weirder things have happened. After all, we did release Macross, and that happened because the stars aligned and it turned out to be the right thing for us and for Harmony Gold to do. If somebody from Harmony Gold is out there, they listen to this podcast, it might spark something in them and they'll get together with us and maybe something can be worked out. But I mean, I never want to say that we can do something or we will do something, because one thing I've learned in this business is that there are just so many unknowns. I mean, it took 2 years to work out the details for doing our first Kickstarter because it was so new that nobody had really used that. And that was dealing with a company we dealt with for like 20 years that we, you know, we knew everybody there, and we've been seeing them for years, but getting everybody to agree, it took a huge amount of time. Now, on the subsequent ones, it's been less, but even Gunsmith Cats, it took about 18 months of working out the details before we were able to finally announce the project. Mm-hmm. And of course, almost every week of that 18 months, I was convinced that it was going to be, we would be able to announce it next week.
Right. Well, I think that is all I have for you. So thank you very much for your time. Would you like to tell everyone where they can find you and your projects online, social media, websites, Kickstarter, et cetera?
Yeah. Animego.com, A-N-I-M-E-I-G-O. On Twitter at Animego. Also on my personal Twitter is at Mad Overlord. And if you're interested in what Andy Greenberg is doing, he's at Wizard of Wordna.
Okay. Nice.
Yeah. And let's see what else. Yeah, we're on Facebook and stuff like that, but I'm not a big social media person. I'm, you know, that's for kids these days. But we do post anytime we're doing something new. And you know, the animoto.com website, you can just buy all of our stuff. It's all there.
All right, great. Well, thank you, Robert. And I'm going to wrap up now by saying that I'm Jeremy Parrish. You can find me on Twitter as GameSpite. You can find Retronauts at Apple Podcasts, Podcast One, at retronauts.com. And of course, we're supported through Patreon. Check us out there. Get early access to the show. It's awesome. And that wraps it up for this week. So thanks, everyone. And thank you, Robert, once again, for having me here and sharing so much of this history behind wizardry and just the RPG in general. It's great.
My pleasure.
Pluto TV is the leading free streaming television service. Watch more than 100 TV channels and thousands of movies on demand, all for free. No credit card needed and no sign up. Pluto TV is the easy and completely legal way to watch your favorite TV shows and hit movies. What are you waiting for? Never pay for TV again. Download Pluto TV for free on all your favorite devices today.
My new $4.99 sourdough patty melt combo with two types of melty cheeses is the perfect comfort food for the uncomfortable things in life, like guys named Ronald. There's just something about that name. Try my $4.99 sourdough patty melt combo, only at Jack in the Box. Limited time only. Price and participation may vary. Small fries and small drink.
The Mueller Report. I'm Ed Donahue with an AP News Minute. President Trump was asked at the White House if Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation report should be released next week when he will be out of town.
I guess from what I understand, that will be totally up to the Attorney General.
Maine's Susan Collins says she would vote for a congressional resolution disapproving of President Trump's emergency declaration to build a border wall, becoming the first Republican senator to publicly back it. In New York, the wounded supervisor of a police detective killed by friendly fire was among the mourners attending his funeral. Detective Brian Simonson was killed as officers started shooting at a robbery suspect last week. Commissioner James O'Neill was among the speakers today at Simonson's funeral.
It's a tremendous weight to bear, knowing that your choices will directly affect the lives of others. But cops like Brian don't shy away from it. It's the very foundation of who they are and what they do.
The robbery suspect and a man police say acted as his lookout have been charged with murder. I'm Ed Donahue.